Some royal history books to listen to around the time of King Charles III's coronation. First, The Trial of Charles I by C.V. Wedgwood. In 10 weeks, Cromwell's men defeated the king, tried and executed him, and proclaimed a republic. This is a new interpretation by a master of historical narrative of the events and personalities of one of the most dramatic stories of English political history.
The English nation are a sober people, however at present infatuated, King Charles had written from Newport to his son. They were not so infatuated as to be unable to mock at their plight. One of the most popular ballads in London at the time was a string of doggerel verses deriding the idea of majority rule, the conflicting claims of the sects, and the rumours about the fate of the king. Now, thanks to the powers below, we have even done our due. The mitre is down, and so is the crown, and with them the coronet too. There is no such thing as a bishop or a king, or peer, but in name or show. Come clowns and come boys, come hobbledehoys, come females of each degree. Stretch out your throats, bringing in your votes, and make good the anarchy. We are 80 religions strong, then take your choice, the major voice shall carry it, right or wrong. Then let's have King Charles, says George. Nay, we'll have his son, says Hugh. Nay, then let's have none, says jabbering Joan. Nay, we'll all be kings, says Prue. But ballads and gaiety were declining, not merely because of the Puritan triumph. A foreign visitor who returned to England after the Civil Wars found that the people, whom he remembered as friendly and good-humoured, had become melancholy, spiteful, as if bewitched. They had cause for gloom. There had been no settled government for over 6 years. Taxation to pay for the war had been introduced by Parliament in 1643 on a nationwide basis and had continued ever since. The hated excise, a purchase tax, enhanced the price of most essential goods, while every household in the country had to contribute to the so-called weekly assessment to pay the running expenses of the war. The king's adherents, from the highest almost to the lowest, had had to compound, or in other words, to pay fines, which were somewhat arbitrarily calculated in relation to their resources and the extent to which they had actively participated in the fighting.
The Trial of Charles I by C.V. Wedgwood is narrated by Andrew Gemmell and lasts 8 hours 50 minutes. Our second book and our second Charles, King Charles II by Antonia Fraser. The life story of possibly the best loved of all English monarchs. From his youth, being born to reconcile the divided world, on through the execution of his father in exile, to the restoration and the many enigmas of his reign.
A quote from the Eve of Coronation address to Charles II in 1661. Great sir, the star which at your happy birth joyed with his beams at noon the wandering earth, did with auspicious lustre then presage the glittering plenty of this golden age. At Dover, on the 25th of May, 1660, the flags waved, the trumpets blew, and high above the heads of the crowd, vast indications of new glories could be seen, the royal arms publicly flaunted in joy. On the sea voyage, however, the king himself deliberately turned his thoughts back to the past. He was, as usual, physically active and stirring, striding up and down the deck. But his conversation was of old times. He talked, almost gossiped, of that flight after Worcester. It was a significant recitation, for the king was speaking not so much to Samuel Pepys, making notes at his side, as to himself. This king, who was about to be restored, never intended to let himself forget what he had endured, and might one day have to endure again. Thus he dwelt consciously on the nadir of his fortunes, where other men might have been puffed up with contemplation of the future. Not that life on board was all retrospection. Before they sailed, there had been pleasanter diversions, such as the renaming of the royal ships, to rescue them from their unpleasant protectoral nomenclature. This probably took place on the quarter-deck table under the awning. Thus the Richard, Cromwell, became the James, Duke of York. The Speaker of the House of Commons became the Mary, Princess of Orange. And the Dunbar, oh, hateful Scottish word, the Henry for the Duke of Gloucester. Pepys, like many of those suddenly enjoying intimate contact with royalty, allowed himself to be charmed by such evidence of the king's humanity as the fact that his dogs were busy making messes on the deck, just like any other dogs. Finally, at the king's suggestion, the three royal brothers, Charles, James, and Henry, tucked into a seaman's breakfast of pork, peas, and boiled beef.
King Charles II by Antonia Fraser is narrated by John Westbrook and runs for 25 hours, 48 minutes. Our final royal historical book, Crown and Country by David Starkey. The monarchy is one of Britain's longest surviving institutions, as well as one of its most tumultuous and revered. David Starkey looks at the monarchy as a whole, charting its history from Roman times to the War of the Roses, the chaos of the Civil War, the fall of Charles I and Cromwell's emergence as Lord Protector, all the way up to the Victorian era when Britain's monarchs came face to face with modernity.
One of William's first acts in England had been to build a castle to secure his camp at Hastings. The scene is vividly represented in the Bayeux Tapestry. William sits in council with his two half-brothers, Bishop Odo and Robert, Count of Mortain. The latter issues the order to build the castle. Workmen with picks and shovels throw up the pudding-shaped motte, or mound, which is crowned with a wooded stockade. The motte was one essential feature of the castle. The other was the bailey, or stockaded enclosure, at the foot of the motte. These motte and bailey castles, like the mounted knights and archers which had won Hastings, were another mark of the Normans' military superiority. They were standardised, quick and easy to build, using forced labour and the plentiful supplies of local timber, and above all, they were effective. On his march to London, after the Battle of Hastings, William strengthened the fortifications of Dover, and from his residence at Barking, he used the first weeks of 1067 to supervise the construction of another castle at London, to the southeast of the city, on the site of the present tower. William's first two English castles at Hastings and Dover were designed to secure his communications with Normandy. His third, at London, was intended to overawe the capital city. Now, Odo, from his base at Dover, and Robert, from his at Norwich, were building more. Anglo-Saxon England had seen nothing like them. The burhs, or fortified towns, were designed to protect the people. The motte and bailey castles were there to intimidate them. And they did. With their raw earth and wood set in a tree-denuded landscape, each was the symbol of a profoundly alien military occupation.
Crown and Country by David Starkey is narrated by Tim Pigott-Smith and runs for 15 hours and 12 minutes. For more information about these royal books and well over 30,000 other titles of fiction and non-fiction, head to rniblibrary.com or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 and ask about Talking Books.